morning, family. All right. My name is Stephen Aguaya. I have the privilege of serving with the amazing campus ministry. Woo! That's campus for you. That's our language. Woo. So we are going to be continuing our study on the book of Mark, looking at Jesus in action. Today we're going to be looking at Mark 2 from verse 13 to 17. But before we do that, let's pray. God, thank you so much, Father, for loving us. God, thank you for choosing us to belong to you. God, I pray that as we look at your word this morning, that you remove all the distractions and help us be saturated by how incredible you are. Pray that all of us leave here with the desire to be more like your son. Thank you for all you've blessed us with already. All this I pray in your son's name. Amen. All right, just echoing what Ebony talked about, the campus ministry had just an incredible weekend last weekend, and also Tyreek Henderson was baptized. So, Tyreek, are you here? We got a lot of guys sick, like physically sick. So pray for the campus ministry. There's something going around more than high interest rates on tuition, you know. It's rough. So at this point in Mark, we've seen John the Baptist present Jesus. We've seen Jesus call some of the first disciples. We've seen Jesus heal. We've seen Jesus get interrupted by people, get interrupted by paralyzed guys dropping from the ceiling. We've seen Jesus do a lot. And now in verse 13 of Mark 2, we see another very powerful interaction. So I'm going to read from there. Mark 2, verse 13. It says, once again, Jesus went out beside the lake. A large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. As he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, Jesus told him, and Levi got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him, and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? On hearing this, Jesus said to them, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Incredible passage we have here. And very early on, we're introduced to this character whose name is Levi. Now, Levi, it says that he was a tax collector in the collector's booth. Now, what this was an ancient equivalent of how we have our toll booths here. And you know how that is. Sometimes I'm grateful that I have an easy pass, not for the convenience, but just so I don't have to give any person my money. Just handing over that, you know, $1.17. Or you can spend almost $50 going back and forth from New York from here. And that's just, you know, it's, where is that money going to? I don't know. But that's our dilemma, but we're essentially in luxury. What was going on here is that in this tax collector's booth, Levi would have been hired by the Roman government to unfairly collect taxes from a financially crippled Jewish community. His fellow Jews would have hated him on many levels, on more than the fact that he's taking money from them, but the fact that they would have felt like, well, you're supposed to be on our side here. You're supposed to be taking care of us. But you're siding with the enemy and taking our money. And the Romans actually didn't like them that much either. They were just pawns that were kind of played to get the job done in areas that the Roman government didn't want to go to. It was a lonely life that was made to look glamorous by the promise and facade of steady income. But his understanding of his position and his awareness of what that reputation would mean was that he had most likely settled that this is just going to be my life. I'm going to be taken care of financially, but I'm going to be hated. I'm going to be alone. I'm not going to have friends or family because there's nowhere for me to turn in order to get that. Now, Levi in Hebrew means joined or attached or connected. And there's no doubt that the joke must have been, well, Levi joined himself with the enemy. He attached himself with the Roman government. He joined to this status as a traitor. He's joined to a life of being by himself. And he's stuck there. He's attached to that. He's not moving any way from that. And some of us may not have to imagine. Some of us may not even need to have that great of a creativity to kind of to relate to being isolated or being separated or feeling like or feeling alone or lonely or even amongst crowds, feeling like no one really understands what I'm going through. And Jesus, in walks Jesus and sees Levi in the tax collector's booth, not at church on Sunday, not in a point of like, oh, you know, in where he's adoring God by any means. He sees Levi while Levi is in his dirt, while he's in his position of doing this thing that he knows is wrong, and says, you, come follow me. You in the guy in the tax collector's booth with everyone else there, he points to him and says, you, Levi, follow me. Thank God that Jesus doesn't look at the outside like we do. Thank God that Jesus isn't distracted by all of our decorations, that he misses our heart. In fact, if you want to write down 1 Samuel 16:7, says that God doesn't look at the outward appearance like man does, but he looks at our hearts. Levi was hated, disowned, corrupted, abandoned, seen to be weak-willed, a dirty tax collector, joined with the enemy. But you know who else he was? The Apostle Matthew. That's Levi. Look at Matthew 9:9 real quick. Matthew 9, verse 9. Same story. As Jesus went out from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? This is the same guy, the apostle Matthew. Now, in the Bible, there's many examples of significant name changes. Abram gets his name changed by God to Abraham because Abraham means father of multitudes. And God says, hey, Abram, I'm going to make you a father of multitudes. So he changes his name to Abraham. Sarai has her name changed to Sarah because Sarah means mother of nations. And God is like, hey, Sarah, you're going to be a mother of nations. Simon means God hears, gets his name changed to rock as a foundation, like rock as a foundation, like a strong ground to build on. And Jesus says, you're going to have the keys to the kingdom. I'm going to build this on your confession of who I am. And you're going to be the guy that's going to explain how to get in. So your name is now going to be rock. Saul, who was most likely, he gave that name to himself. Saul means, I'm such a big deal that God prays about me. That's what Saul means. Paul means small or insignificant. So after contact with Christ, he changes his name to Paul. Like these are very, I mean, it's a name change, but it's a very significant change of heart and character and all of that, because correct contact with God will change how you see yourself and will change how others see you. So do not let who you think you are get in the way of God who knows you can be. I said that funny, right? Do not let who you think you are get in the way of who God knows you can be. If for this side of the room, don't ever play yourself. Don't ever play yourself. Don't ever play yourself. That's everyone else. Don't let who you think you are get. Okay, yeah. But God, I'm just a teenager. Like I'm only like I'm in high school. I live with my parents. What could I possibly be, or what could I do? Well, you know, high school is a dark place. High school is rough. You can be a light in a place in desperate need for spiritual examples. You can be someone that is a joy to parent and change your family dynamic. Yep. Oh, man. Yeah. but God, I'm just in college. I'm just making a little bit of money. I'm just. Well, you can do incredible things if we stop thinking about who we are just and just focus on who Christ is. Because Levi by himself, correct. Levi, you are just a tax collector. That's actually a pretty sweet deal for you. Now, you know, if you think about it, because you'll be able to take care of yourself. You know, good luck having a family, but it's just you, and that's fine. That's just your capabilities. But Jesus is like, oh no, that guy is an apostle. He's gonna be one of my 12 that I changed the world with. He's gonna die for this because he's given everything to follow me. If we just stop doubting and putting our focus so much in who we are just, and just put our faith in who Christ is, we will not only change yourself, but the world will change as well. Our schools will change as well. Our workplaces will change as well. If we focus on who God is rather than who we are just. The crowd saw Levi. Jesus saw Matthew. Hey, Matthew, come follow me. If you are in Christ, you are a lot of things, but you are also, and most importantly, a saved member of God's family. And that's a hard thing to put just on. That's a very big deal. Now, back to this idea of name changes. Sometimes nicknames carry more weight than your actual name. So my dad calls my younger sister Neh because that's kind of like an homage to his mother. And that's kind of a connection that they have there. My dad was like the ultimate mama's boy. So something to like attach his mom to and his daughter is a really, really big deal. He calls me big guy because I'm big and I'm a guy. He calls my younger brother Hurricane because he used to like destroy things. Just like, yeah, shake stuff up. But that has kind of shifted from a, you know, Hurricane Andrew to Andrew's power and resilience. Because my dad has seen Andrew work through very, very difficult times. I'm more comfortable being Hannah's husband than I am being Stephen. Like I'm way more excited about the fact that that's my wife than I am who I am. Like the fact that she calls me babe, oh man, I'm with it. If she calls me Stephen, I'm probably in trouble, and I probably did something that that hopefully I can earn the babe back. But these names, like saved member of God's family, that's more important than Stephen. That's more important than however you may see yourself. So a question we have to ask ourselves is like, you know, does Christ, if Christ comes in this room, does he have a nickname for you as well? Or are you so set on who you are that you are unwilling to change to become who he sees you as potentially being? Because that, you know, I think we're so, I don't know when this started, but there is this, like, no one can tell me who I'm going to be. No one can tell me what I'm going to do or what I'm going to think. I'm an individual. I'm a snowflake. Yeah, there's no one else like me. I'm unique, and no one tell me anything else. It's like, well, what if that person is Christ? Like, what if Jesus is saying you need to be different? You need to change. You know, finding like security and standing firm when Christ is saying you need to be something different is not a good idea. When Christ says, come follow me, it's not just walk behind me. There's an implication of your life's gonna have to change. It's like recruit in the army. Like when someone says recruit, you know you're not just gonna follow the guy that does the recruiting. If someone says pledge this fraternity, you know you're not just gonna walk behind the guy that like you have to change a lot about who you are. Follow me means changing who you are. Levi changed his whole life. I am no longer going to be a tax collector. Done with that. That's my old life now. I'm not going to let it define. It can refine me. My experiences can refine who I'm going to be, but that doesn't define me anymore. That's no longer who I am. And because Jesus is better than what I was doing before, and he can change me. Now, that's a past tense statement that Matthew would have thought. But family, Jesus is better than whatever you have going on right now, and he can change you. And that's power. Now, it's also important to note here that Levi doesn't transform to Matthew because of a belief that Christ is worth changing for. He doesn't actually changes. This is worthy of being changed for. So he actually changes. Like, there wasn't just this, oh, I agree, Jesus. I accept your message. I accept that I should follow you. No, he actually follows him. And I think we have to be careful that we don't get caught in this, like, confusing agreement with surrender. They may look similar depending on who you hang out with, but those are two very, very different lifestyles. And Levi decided to surrender and give up everything in order to follow Jesus. And you know what Matthew means? Gift of God. It's like, it's beautiful. Gift of God. And instead of focusing on the gift that Christ was offering, of the ability to change and have lunch with him, the Pharisees were in the background hating, because that's what haters do. Hate in the back. Let's look at verse 15 real quick. It says, while Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples. And then the last question they ask is, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? For a second, let's remove the question. Let's remove the question mark for that and look at the statement. Jesus eats with tax collectors and sinners. Now, eating with someone is an act of befriending them or a result of an already established friendship that you have with that person, at least in these times. And I think it carries over now as well. If you want to, you know, make me your friend, invite me to something where there's food and we're good. Now, some of the campus students, and what we're doing is we're trying to read the Bible cover to cover. I think at this point we're around 1 Samuel. And it's great seeing God work, seeing all that. It's great. But one of the most, the most consistent theme in this first, like, maybe 15% of the Bible is humans, is God's chosen people giving God reason after reason after reason to give up on us. It's actually pretty discouraging to see what happened in God history to even get to this point in Mark 2 right now. So you have Adam and Eve, here's everything you need. And no, you know what, God, we're going to do things on our own. Cain and Abel, I'm going to kill this guy because he set a standard higher than what I'm willing to follow. The world that Noah was living in, and then God rescues his people from Egypt, takes them out of slavery, captivity, and they constantly complain and grumble and prostitute themselves to the highest bidder and worshiping other gods and other nations just over and over and generation and generation and corrupt kings and corrupt leaders. And how does God repay us? By befriending us, by having lunch with us, by empathizing with human hunger. Like, for Jesus to eat with these guys, like, he has to make himself human and feel the need to eat. So after we abuse him, he comes down to feel our pain and like go through what we go through and heals us and teaches and loves and woos us back into a relationship with him. But Jesus eats with sinners. He treats them as friends and companions. That's God. And I think sometimes I create this scenario for myself where I get to determine what mercy and forgiveness is. And I feel like, well, no, that's, God's not going to forgive me for this. God establishes himself as the definition of mercy and forgiveness. And it's not just this idea like kind of, okay, I'm going to forgive and forget and literally forget you. And I don't want to ever see you again. It's acknowledging how much I've let him down. He wants me to be a friend. Like he wants to be that connected with me. And I think, honestly, I think there are times that we get so caught up in what we think we deserve that we don't remember that God actually has incredible plans for us. You know, I think I've seen people communicate that they don't feel worthy of God's love. Well, you're not. You're right. But he's chosen to love you, aware of all of the stuff you've done, all the stuff you're going to do. He wants to be your friend. He wants to eat with you. The question is actually less significant than the statement here. Jesus eats with sinners, and guess what? That's us. And Jesus is willing to sit and eat with us and spend time with us and get to know us. Now, are you willing to do the same with him? Because the Pharisees aren't eating with him. They're in the back hating because, again, that's what haters do. They miss out on the food. But they're out looking. What's this guy doing? Hey, other apostles, why is your teacher fraternizing with the enemy right now? Like, what's going on? And they missed out on the opportunity to sit and eat with God because they were pointing fingers and trying to understand God better than God understands himself. Are you willing to sit and befriend Christ? And I think in church on a Sunday like this, of course we are, because you know we're amongst people that are willing to do the same thing. I think the challenge becomes befriending God when it's just you, when it's just you there. Are you going to associate yourself with Christ? Peter, as we know in the crucifixion story, has an opportunity to befriend Christ in a very difficult time, and he's like, I have never seen that man in my life. I came for the bonfire. I didn't know that they were doing a trial. What's going on here? And Peter, and he's the guy. This is like the Christ, wherever you go, I got your back. And I think, you know, in a crowd, sure, we can be, I got you. But what happens when it's just you? The last time I preached, someone told me that, like, you know, Stephen, you have a lot of embarrassing stories about yourself. Anything good ever happened? Like, well, thanks. Thank you for pointing that out. But, you know, there is something that at the time I didn't see as significant, but I feel like, you know, years removed, I'm grateful that I experienced it. Junior year of college, I took a Bible literature course, which was an English class that was not, it was not in the religious track at all. It was literally, like, the class description was, we are going to analyze the Bible as a work of literature. And I was like, oh, easy, A. I know the Bible. I don't even have to do the reading. I do that as, like, a personal thing. I'll be fine. It was a three-and-a-half-hour class, Monday and Wednesday from 7 in the morning to 10:30, and she promised a break, never gave a break. We never saw that like 15-minute rest that she promised. But in my mind, it's just like I need another class in English 300. This is gonna be a cakewalk. My mom said, don't take the class. I was like, Mom, you don't know college, obviously. This is come on now. It's look at the description. It's always what the description says. Yeah. So first day of class, this professor makes us, you know, raise your hand if you believe in God. Well, you know, most people raise their hand. And then she goes on to explain how Down syndrome and belief in God are practically the same thing. So I never dropped a class in college, never. Not because of any integrity. I just was too lazy to go through the process of dropping classes. So I had made a resolve to take this class. But day one, she is guns blazing. Like, you cannot be this dumb to believe this stuff. So let's look at it like a fairy tale. Oh, man, it was rough. It was an early in the morning. Rough and early in the morning, just not a great combination. And I got a lot of advice. I was like, one day, I was a little bit fed up. She was going on this very, very long explanation about how, okay, let's say that a Jesus human existed. There is no way that there was a crucifixion or a resurrection. It just, logically, again, if it's in a movie, sure, but definitely not in real life. But like, she was doing it in like you're stupid for believing this. And this professor was Jewish, and I raised my hand very late in the semester, and I said, you know, professor, I have not necessarily a question, but a statement here, and I'll preface it by saying, like, what would you feel if? So what would you feel if I said that the Holocaust never happened? Actually, let me, and then I said, actually, remove the what would you feel if? What if I told you that I actually have done some research that proves that the Holocaust was a bunch of doctored images and propaganda used to make one group look a lot worse than the other? How would that make you feel? And then I'm like, oh, I said it. Okay, it's out. Now what? And of course, quiet. It's quiet for a while. She was very upset, and what I communicated with her was, you know, I'm not saying that's the case. I actually genuinely do, you know, I really do believe that the atrocities that happened during that time, they were real and people were affected by it. But let me just kind of clarify something for you. That speaking for myself and many people that I'm close to, they are individuals that have decided now and throughout for the past 2,000 years, there are individuals that have decided to live and give their lives up on the premise that Jesus in fact existed, was crucified, and raised again. So the level of disrespect that it takes for someone to look at that and make fun of it is something that I'm not willing to stand by. And if you would like someone to explain to you how factual Christ's life, death, and resurrection was, please, let's talk after class. And I'm sweating. Like, it doesn't look as cool because I'm like sweating and kind of bumbling through my words. But what I needed to communicate, really not to her but to the class, was that there are people willing to stand up for Jesus. There are people that are willing that in a scenario where they can get away with being quiet, are not going to do that, and are going to put their foot down and say, "No, I'm not going to be the guy that gets beat up here. Like, Christ has to be real." Because I gave my life up for him, so there's no way that I'm not going to sit here and unless you continue. The final paper that she had us write. This is, I want to, if I made that statement with a month left of class, our final paper was assignment was handed out the next week. The paper said, based on the inconsistencies of the facts that are recorded throughout history, but more specifically, the inconsistencies found within the gospel, present a 25 to 30 page paper on why Christ's life cannot be seen as valid. So I was going to write two papers. That was my initial thought. I was going to write a paper and mark one, grade this with what she wanted to hear. And then I was going to write another one saying, but then here's what I actually believe, and send in both. But I'm not writing two papers. Come on now. So I wrote the one, like, well, here's what the Bible actually says, Professor. And I went on to kind of explain the differences and how those differences make it more reliable than there being four carbon copies of the same information. And I got an A minus in the class. I think the minus was spite, because it was a really good paper. Like, it was, I was very emotional about what I was writing. It was good. That's a classroom at school with me being kind of frustrated. Now I think I then need to have that same resolve when it's just me and my thoughts. Like when I'm out and there's an opportunity for me to have a sinful thought. Like, am I that willing to stand up for Jesus in those moments? Can I sit and befriend Christ when no one's going to know but me and him? Jesus is willing to sit and eat with me. I just need to do the same for him. Verse 17, and we'll close. On hearing this, Jesus said to them, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." We need to realize, I mean, it just logic. Like, you're not going to go to the hospital unless you realize you're sick. You're not going to go see a doctor unless you realize you need to see a doctor. Jesus looked at all of us and said they need healing. I spent my longest, like, sick time. I had a peptic ulcers, and I was in the hospital for like 10 days. In the hospital room that I was in, there was a guy that was racing motorcycles with no shirt, and he fell and like took off all of his back skin. All of it, right? The other guy was playing racquetball and slipped, and a piece of the, what do you call racquetball floor? Just like the wood, the plywood, whatever. It had splintered up, and it was a shard like this that just kind of went from the bottom of his throat down to like his belly button. And I'm sitting there like, man, I just got a stomach ache, and these guys are out here with like life-ending stuff. But they saw my situation like, man, you must have it really hard. How does it feel having the internal da 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 da? All of us were sick. If you're in a hospital, you're sick. If it's there for a splinter, or you got an eye infection, or you are terminal, if you're in a hospital, you're sick. We just got to get ourselves to the hospital and have Jesus fix us. Because if we're not looking at it as a ranking, and if you remove the like what your illness is called, and just look at it as an illness, that's what sin is. Forget what sin you're dealing with. It's sin, and we need to get ourselves to the physician so he can fix us. Now, the doctor that saw me gave me some medicine and walked away. Christ dies as the medicine. What? Like, the doctor that's going to see you the next time you go to the hospital is going to tell you what to do. If he goes like above and beyond, he may give you his personal number, and you guys might have dialogue at some point, maybe. Christ gives himself as the medication. I'm going to put all of me, and it's going to kill me so I can heal you. So not only does he change our names, not only does he decide to eat with us, but he sees how wretched we are, and doesn't point fingers. He says, okay, I'll sacrifice myself for this group. I'll die so that they can be healthy. But they must first understand that they are sick. Now, because illness is illness, and none of us are perfect, regardless of how you came in here today, we need to remember that Christ has offered himself up for us. But you're going to have to take it. And you're not going to take it if you don't think you need it. If you think you've got to a place where you no longer need Christ's forgiveness, you're not going to take Christ. And if you don't take Christ, you don't have Christ. We need to constantly be at a state of understanding how desperately we need Christ's sacrifice every single day, every moment of every day. And that's why communion isn't a Sunday 11 o'clock activity. Communion is how we exist. The constant reminder of goodness gracious, this God became man, changed who we are, decided to eat with us, and now is constantly healing me. Not a one-time fix, but Christ every single day is healing me. I can't take that for granted. I need to live differently. I need to change how I view myself. I need to change how other people view me. I need to live a life so like different from what I was doing before that it becomes obvious that I've been healed. And that's the power of the cross. The ability to take Christ's sacrifice and live healed lives, live transformed lives, because Jesus is in the business of transformation. That's just what he does. And if we agree to the transformation and we act out that transformation, then Christ's death is not just a historical fact, because it is a historical fact. It's not just that. It becomes something we can daily reference back to as, man, that's why I live the way I'm living right now. So as we take the communion, and we take the bread that represents his body and the juice that represents his blood, remember that. Remember all that Christ had to do to make this possible. Let's live grateful lives, but let's remember that we're supposed to be transformed. Different names, different ideals, different everything, different eternity because of how much Jesus loved us. Amen.